So as we turn to Genesis chapter 10 this morning, you might have come anticipating that the most exciting thing that you would experience is how I might butcher some of these difficult to pronounce names here as we study this chapter. I guess I look at it sort of like my days as an umpire. You know, you have to sell the call. I mean, you have to. If you don't know how to pronounce the name, it's not like I spent all week studying the pronunciation of these names. I didn't think that was a good investment of my time. So we'll take a shot at these, but we'll just kind of sell it with a little bit of false confidence here. So I apologize to these individuals. If I don't get it right, they can correct me later, maybe. But so actually, this account in Genesis 10, I'm sure it's skipped over by many expositors. I'm sure you don't have a whole list of notes back home of what you've heard from Genesis chapter 10. But as I studied it this week, as I thought about it, I think it's significant on a number of different levels. Certainly from the standpoint of history. I mean, here you have a historical account of the origins of all of these nations. So this is a book of beginnings. That's what Genesis is. And so we can trace back all of these peoples and languages and geographies and political entities. We can trace all of this back to what happened to those who came out of Noah's Ark. How was God at work in repopulating the earth as he gave the commission there to Noah's three sons? This is a unique list, this list of nations that we find here. The other ancient peoples, even though you might find parallel flood accounts and you might find, you know, parallel other types of stories, you don't find any parallel that has the type of accuracy and detail that this list provides from a historical standpoint in terms of the origin of these nations. Secondly, I think, you know, this chapter is intended to provide the important background for the Tower of Babel story that we're going to see in chapter 11. Really, chapters 10 and 11 form more of a unit together. They're at the end of that first section of the two major sections in the book of Genesis. Remember, chapters 1 through 11 talk about the early days of human history, and then you get from chapters 12 on, you get God turning away his attention from sort of a global, worldwide focus. He turns his attention to the chosen people that come from the line of Abraham, and you have the patriarchal record of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the Jewish people. And so you have a very different focus beginning in Genesis chapter 12. So what we have in chapters 10 to 11 are a unity that really, at the heart of this unity, there's a little bit of a chiastic structure because you have the sons of Shem that are addressed at the end of Genesis chapter 10. Then you have the Tower of Babel incident. And then if you look at Genesis 11 chapter 10, it says again, another Toledot reference, it says, these are the records of the generations of Shem. And it repeats and reviews again some of the same genealogy of Shem. So you have this chiastic structure, ABA, with at the heart of the Tower of Babel being what's central and what the Lord is speaking of. So as we look at this account, as we read chapter 10, different sections of it, you'll be noticing the key words that jump out at you, words that are all preparing our hearts in anticipation of what's going to happen immediately in chapter 11 of the Tower of Babel. There'll be words like the spread, how these nations are going to spread, words like division, separation, how the nations are going to separate and divide from one another, words like languages, how there's going to be languages. Up to this time, there's been a commonality of language, and yet, as this is written after the, obviously, the time of the Tower of Babel incident, these words, these key words are in here, which point our hearts to what's going to happen and how important that Tower of Babel incident is. And then, thirdly, and maybe of primary significance, importance, I think this chapter, it speaks to the global perspective of God's program for mankind, that he's not to be boxed in as just the God of Israel. That is not how we should limit our outlook upon God. God has always been a God of all peoples. He's the God, as we just sung our last song, he gave life to all living creatures. He's the one who's concerned for the salvation of all mankind. He has a heart for all peoples. So he is portrayed, I think, in this chapter, as we see all of these nations arise, our curiosity should be stirred as to what is going to be their relationship to the eternal God, to their creator. what's going to be their relationship. They all stem from good roots in terms of they can trace their lineage all the way back to Noah, who was a righteous man. And yet, those who come from a righteous lineage, there's no guarantee that they will stay on course. It's the same in our families. We can have all types of dedication ourselves to the Lord. That's no guarantee that our children are going to be faithful and are going to want to be loyal and love the Lord Jesus. And so it's the same in these chapters here. They trace their lineage back to Noah, and yet everybody's responsible and accountable for their own decisions that they make, and they have the opportunity to love God or to not love God. And so here we see just the missionary heart of God. I think we're attracted to the grace of God, thinking of his salvation program and how the seed of the woman would come, not just to bless Israel, but in fact the intention of God's choice of Israel was that Israel would be a blessing to the whole world, and that they would be God's lighthouse and God's means of reaching out and showing his law and goodness and revelation to entire mankind. And so I think of verses like Psalm chapter 2, verse 8, as you have the Godhead dialoguing amongst themselves there. And it says, "Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, the very ends of the earth as your possession." So as we have this messianic psalm here, Psalm 2, we see the interest that God the Father, that God the Son have in all the ends of the earth, which is what we have portrayed for us in Genesis chapter 10. So those are some of the areas of significance, I think, as we get into chapter 10 here. There's some structural elements that I always like to try and note at the outset that help me get my arms around the section. And that is, first of all, the bookends that you see at the beginning verse and the last verse of chapter 10. It starts out in chapter 10, verse 1. Now, these are the records. Again, this is the Toledot section that we've noted very often. That's the division point as you go through the book of Genesis. Now, these are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and sons were born to them after the flood. And so you have the immediate generation after Noah, his three sons, and then it speaks of the generations to follow, the sons that were to be born from the lineage. You have three lines that you're going to track that come from these three sons of Noah. That is picked up and repeated in summary fashion in the last verse, in verse 32. As we conclude the chapter, you have this bookend statement: these are the families of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies. Then it gives us a little more definition, a little more breakdown as to what is distinct about these different nations and tribes that are being related here. It says you can separate them out by their nations, and it's even in the verse above. The verse above, which is a bookend section for the section about Shem, really sort of merges together with verse 32. So let's read verse 31 too. These are the sons of Shem. So it's the conclusion of the sons of Shem section. According to their families, according to their languages, by their lands, according to their nations. Look at all those marks of differentiation that we have come to see as we study this chapter. And then it is the bookend summary statement. These are the families of the sons of Noah according to their genealogies, by their nations, and out of these, the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. And of course, that merges right away into chapter 11 and the story of the Tower of Babel. Now, there's a common refrain as well as we study these three lines. The theme of this chapter, I think, is that the God who chose Israel is the sovereign God who's over all the nations. So again, this is not a limited God. We want to see God not just as a God of Israel, but we want to see God as sovereign over all the nations. And as this thought is developed, it's developed through these three distinct lines that the sons of Noah are going to produce. So the sons of Noah are going to produce three distinct lines of nations. It's going to track through the sons of Japheth in verses 2 to 5, the sons of Ham in verses 6 to 20, and the sons of Shem in verses 21 to 31. But in each of these three sections, you have a common refrain that finishes the section. The last verse in each of these three sections is a common verse. Look at how this structural element plays out. So in verse 5, talks about, "From these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations." So of course, our ears perk up at this instance of, you know, specific language and the separations and the divisions, because there's been a common language up to this point. So again, it's preparing us for, well, how is this separation of language going to come about? And then at the end of the second section, in verse 20, it reads, these are the sons of Ham, the second line that's developed here, according to their families, according to their languages, by their lands, by their nations. And then we already read verse 31, which is the conclusion to this section on Shem. So those are some structural elements. The importance of this refrain here that's used at the end of each section, I like some of the research that Van Paranak did here. He traced through the scriptures and looked at how some of the pagan kings, in terms of claiming their own sovereignty, their independence, how great they are in their own kingdoms, they would ascribe some of this same language to themselves, as if they're the ones who are in control of all the language and all the families and all of the geopolitical divisions and all of the lands and geographies. You know, they would take that type of language and try to apply it to themselves, of course, in a feudal type of way. And so Van Paranak notes how Nebuchadnezzar used this. If you turn over to Daniel chapter 4, we'll see two instances in the book of Daniel, and then how God applies it to himself. In Daniel chapter 4, verse 1, looking at this same, again, the same phraseology that we have as the refrain in these three sections in Genesis chapter 10. So in Daniel chapter 4, speaking of Nebuchadnezzar, in chapter 4, it says, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language that live in all the earth. You know, that same reference he's making as here he's finally acknowledging God. So here he's coming out of his cow pasture experience and giving testimony to how God has transformed him in this instance here. But if you look over in Daniel chapter 6, verse 25, you see another king, Darius the king. And he says, and again, these kings actually, in these phrases in Daniel, they're using this to worship, to more ascribe this to God than they are to themselves. Both Nebuchadnezzar and Darius have been humbled by what they've experienced as they've witnessed how God has worked, and they're giving testimony really to how God is the one who is over all of these peoples and nations. So both Nebuchadnezzar and Darius, not so much ascribing to themselves, they're more ascribing it to God. They say, Darius says, as he gives testimony, he says, I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and enduring forever. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. His dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. So talking about how he's the one over all nations. But then how this is ascribed to God himself in chapter 7, the famous chapter in Daniel chapter 7, where you have the vision of the Son of Man. And this language is used here. I kept looking, verse 13 of chapter 7. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming. He came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. To him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So I think as we study Genesis chapter 10, we want to especially focus in on the significance of the sovereignty of God over all of the nations and peoples and languages, and that's what is we see the beginnings of and the origins of back in Genesis chapter 10. Some people commentators have also noted, by way of again a structural element, have noted a numerical aspect that I would never have picked up on myself, but they say that the number of nations, as you track through this section, that there's a symbolic, there's a significance to the fact that there's 70 nations that are recorded in this section here. And of course, it's a number of completeness, a number of perfectness. It's not all the nations of that time that were listed. It's not that every single nation is listed, but the ones that are chosen and that are compiled here, 70 are given. And it turns out in Genesis chapter 46, verse 27, that it speaks of 70 sons of Jacob that went down to Egypt. And so Bruce Waltke, an Old Testament scholar from Dallas Seminary, and then went over to Westminster Seminary, but a very renowned scholar. You know, he talks about, he says, well, really, what you have in terms of the sons of Jacob, 70 of them, you have sort of a microcosm of God working with his own elect people. And then as the 70 nations, you sort of branch out to this macrocosm in a parallel fashion of God working with all the peoples. And so the significance of how that parallels, and I don't know how intentional that is. Again, I would not pick up myself on something like that, but I thought it was interesting to see the parallel. Certainly the number of 7 and 10 and multiples of 7 and 10 are significant throughout the book of Genesis, and that number has symbolism throughout here. So you see that there's this aspect of completeness and of totality that's represented here. But like I said, there's no completeness in the list. There are certain nations like Moab or Ammon or Edom or Amalek. There's nations that are important even to Israel's history, and yet you don't find them mentioned in a way that we can pick out and we can pinpoint. Now, it doesn't mean that they're obviously descendants of somebody here in this section, so they're here. It's just not in a way that stands out to us that pinpoints those nations. So it begins, like I said, in verse 1. You have the first part of this bookend and this prologue that's given here that starts with this Toledot reference. The sections that we're in chapters 10 to 11, there's going to be a lot of references of this Toledot. So there's a lot of different sections because that begins chapter 11, verse 10, chapter 11, verse 27, are other references that start these Toledot sections. So we've been taking sort of big chunks, and now there's a number of references to this important structural division marker here. And then I like this reference from Griffith Thomas. He said that as you look at what happens in terms of how God orders chapter 10, where he lists the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, but then he takes them up in an order where Shem is the last one that he deals with, and he starts more with Japheth and then Ham. And regarding that order, Griffith Thomas says, well, this is an example of a characteristic where in the book of Genesis, God starts out with dealing with sort of the collateral, the outside, the extremity, you know, the Gentiles and the outer types of things. And then he focuses in at the end and concentrates his attention more on the line that comes through Abraham and on the Jewish people. And of course, that's what's going to happen in chapter 12 ongoing. So that's what he's doing in how he's ordering these different lines that are represented in Genesis chapter 10. So the three sons of Noah, they produce these three distinct lines of nations, and we're all included somewhere in this account that's given. The first one here, the first section is very short, verses 2 to 5, and so it's not given a lot of focus. There are not specific individuals that jump out by way of distinction where they're given a lot of play. It just talks about the sons of Japheth and talks about them in terms of sort of the outer extremities, sort of the Mediterranean coastline type of people, the ones that were in the islands and in some of the nations around the Mediterranean Sea there. And so I have a map that shows some of these designations. It might be a little hard for you to correlate without taking some more time and going back and forth. We're not going to try to be, you know, so specific that we hone in on every entity here and plumb its depths. We'll be taking more, I think, of a high-level view of this here today. But the sons of Japheth, there's of these 70 nations that we talked about, 14 are referenced here in this section of the sons of Japheth. And here's where you have largely the Gentile peoples, and the ones who would be of European descent would be the ones that would be focused in here. All of us would be included in this probably line that comes from the sons of Japheth. So it identifies here them as Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Tiras as a summary fashion that's given in verse 2. Hughes, he gives a little geographical summary of of what's represented in verse 2. He says, these peoples, they lived mostly to the north and the east of Canaan. They spoke the Indo-European languages. Gomer dwelt north of the Caspian Sea. Tubal and Meshek settled around the southern shores of the Black Sea. Tiras lived west of the Black Sea in Thrace. And Madai occupied the area south of the Caspian in what became Media. And then he goes on and talks about Javan and what area he populated. But again, all of this is details that, you know, sort of gets a little bit lost in the shuffle from a homiletical perspective, not something that has a whole lot of play. But it does show, again, this aspect that God's grace extends to all the world. His concern, again, is with the outer extremities, and he starts there with identifying the sons of Japheth. The two that he's going to focus in on are the sons of Gomer and the sons of Javan. And so he goes and he gives a little more specifics about them. Throughout this chapter, as you'll see, sometimes there's an emphasis both on the peoples and the geographic region that they were associated with. And so in verses 4 to 5, you see the identification of the sons of Javan, and it lists off who they are. And then it gives a little bit about the territory and the diversity aspect. It says, from these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. And so all the terminology there are all those key words that we talked about that get our attention directed towards what's upcoming, being the Tower of Babel incident, which will be the explanation of how is it that these tongues came to be in terms of the diversity. How is it that these nations spread abroad and were not just concentrated in one area? And so this very simply is the short version of what God has recorded here about the Gentile nations and their origins, their beginnings, under the category of the sons of Japheth. Not a whole lot of detail, not, you know, a whole lot that jumps out at us as, hey, this is a spiritual lesson that we glean from this particular section. There's a lot more in the other two lines as we get into them. So verses 6 to 20, you have the sons of Ham. And as we read through this section, what's going to strike us is how so many of the specific enemies of Israel had their identity in this sons of Ham line. And so, of course, we remember from last week how it was that Ham had distinguished himself in a bad way there in the incident with disrespecting his father, and how it was said that one particular line of his sons, the line of Canaan, would end up being in servitude to both the lines of Japheth and the lines of Shem. And so there was that curse that was indicated. And so Ham and Canaan specifically have already gotten our attention as to ones that are sort of on the lowlife end of things. And so it's not surprising that as we're cataloging these nations, the ones that are really going to be a thorn in the side of Israel on a long-term basis are going to come from this family of Ham. So it gives a summary here in verse 6. It starts with this summary, and actually, again, in this section, verses 6 to 20, this summary is a bookend type of summary because it's repeated in verse 20. So you have it in verse 6 and verse 20 in bookend type of fashion. So this is, more of a chiastic type of structure here too. So it says, and the sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan. The one that's not further identified is Put. As you go through this section, even though he singles out the others and says a little bit about who comes down the line from these particular sons, he doesn't say anything with respect to Put. So he sort of gets put on the side. There's not as much reference there. But these ones, they settled primarily in northeast Africa and in Egypt, eastern Mediterranean, southern Arabia. They were right close around the nation of Israel, around Jerusalem. They're right in an area where they could be of a threat and they could be a potential problem. So these are the powerful enemies of Israel. He starts in verses 7 to 14 with an emphasis on the sons of Cush and Mizraim. So he says, here are the sons of Cush. They're Seba and Havilah and Sapta and Rama and Saptika. And then the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. And then he goes in and specifically says, I want to look about this person, Cush, in more detail. So that's the one that's focused on, is Cush, and by virtue of him becoming a father of the one we really want to focus on, and that's Nimrod. So really the main figure in this section is going to be Nimrod. So we want to look at the characteristics of this particular man and why he had such notoriety and prominence and why he sort of comes to the forefront in this section. So Nimrod is identified as a mighty one on the earth. Of course, that terminology brings us back to chapter 6, verse 1, 2, as we talked about before the flood. You had these mighty men of renown that were on the earth, and we talked about their derivation and just how unusual that group was. And so here you have a similar designation given to Nimrod, and so there's that connection that draws our attention back to, are there superhuman types of powers and involved here for Nimrod, or what's going on? He's in a very exclusive category in terms of how he's labeled as this mighty one on the earth. It says then, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, when we think of hunters, we think of ones going out game hunting and, you know, that type of thing. This could very well be talking about, from a violence standpoint, hunting down humans. That this is someone who is such a malicious person, so aggressive, such an oppressive person, that he was especially had renown in the area of hunting down men. And he was a killer. He was a murderer. He was a tyrant. He was a beast of a guy. He was somebody that everybody had to bow down before. So he was somebody that attracted people to him in terms of leadership. He was sort of a natural leader by virtue of his strength and his personality. So he was one that that had people following him. So it was said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. It was just sort of that saying that was ascribed to him. And so he had all types of physical and warrior type of prowess. It says the beginning of his kingdom, now this isn't a good thing, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. So he's connected directly to the Tower of Babel incident in a leadership role, not certainly a very spiritual high calling here. He's the one that his name means, we shall rebel. That's quite a name to have in terms of an anti-God statement, in terms of someone who's set himself up to be sort of a tool of Satan rather than a servant of God. He's one whose life's agenda is to oppose God, is to rebel against God, is to assert his independence. So he's a very distinct individual here, and he's one who goes about creating cities. He's a city builder instead of one who was maybe more engaged in some of the rural areas. He's very much of a as you tend towards nation building, you know, city building and nation building. He was one who was able to galvanize forces again under his leadership. So the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Then he had Erech and Akkad and Calna in the land of Shinar. From that land he went forth. And here's some other names that aren't too attractive from the standpoint of Israel. They aren't friendly to Israel. He's connected with Assyria and its capital Nineveh. He built Nineveh. So he's connected with Babel. So you have the Babylonian Empire. So you have the Babylonians and the Assyrians. You have the two that are going to end up taking the northern and southern area of Israel into captivity. Here's the one that's behind it all. So Nimrod is of such significance here in the biblical account. So he's tied in with all of these superpowers who are enemies of the nation of Israel. And so he's one that that you have to give special attention to. So he's very violent. He's very oppressive. While others on the godly line would go about building altars, he goes about building cities. He's very much characterized as the worldly one, the one who would have the world system. That's why Babylon, even in the book of Revelation, would be symbolic of a whole world system that is against the program of God. And so that's Nimrod. He's as worldly as it gets in terms of instituting world systems that are opposed to God. So he exalts himself and organizes people for those ends. I mean, Babylon stands for everything that's godless and for everything that stands against God. So I think one of the lessons to take away from this emphasis upon Nimrod is, you know, we shouldn't be impressed by what impresses the world. I mean, Nimrod was certainly impressive from a worldly standpoint. He had a lot of people were attracted to him. He had quite the following. And yet, even though he could tout such success and how he's sort of invincible, he wasn't invincible from God's perspective. And so even though there are godless people around us, and they might seem to be successful, they might seem like they have the upper hand even over us and different things, and we're downtrodden or whatever in certain instances, God says that's not the end of the equation. That's not looking at things from an eternal perspective. You have to see that there will be retribution that God dishes out. There will be divine accountability. You can't look at just this one moment in time and take that stamp and say, hey, that's what things are all about. And so when God had pronounced cursing upon Ham and his descendants in that sense, you know, that cursing is going to take effect. And so what you see that's impressive about Nimrod here, about worldliness, are things that God is eventually going to overturn, and God is going to exalt the righteous and the godly, and he is going to cause us to stand for all eternity. And so that's one lesson that I take away from this study on Nimrod. It goes then into the verses 13 to 14. You have the sons of Mizraim who are identified with the nation of the Philistines that come out of that section in verses 13 to 14. So again, another crucial enemy that's going to plague the nation of Israel, the Philistines, come from this line as well. But then verses 15 to 19 focus in on the sons of Canaan, the ones that were specifically addressed in the curse back in chapter 9. So this is the sons of Canaan and their territory. And it says in verse 15, Canaan became the father of Sidon. Remember the Sidonites? So that was his firstborn. And then there was Heth. Remember, Esau married a Hethite to the chagrin of his parents. And so you've got the Hethites that originate here. And look at all the other ites that come here. You've got the Jebusites. Now the Jebusites, that's another name for the city of Jerusalem. The people of Jerusalem populated that area until it came under the dominion of David, and it became known again as Jerusalem. It had been known for the people of the Jebusites that lived in Jerusalem there. So these, again, all these areas are right around the focal point of what God is going to be most concerned with. So you've got the Jebusites, you got the Amorites, you got the Girgashite, you got the Hivites, you got the Arkite, the Sinite, the Arvadite, the Samarite, the Hamathite, whatever it is, the Perizzites. No, the Perizzites aren't there, but you got whatever kind of ites you want, they're listed off here in a negative fashion, these sons of Canaan. And then it gives their territory. Afterward, the families of the Canaanite were spread abroad. The territory of the Canaanite extended from Sidon, as you go toward Gerar, as far as Gaza, as you go toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and other references that we're familiar with, and Adma and Zeboim, as far as Lasha. So, gives the summary again, the same refrain that we've seen this bookend here in verse 20. These are the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, by their lands, and by their nations. And then we turn from this to our focus in verses 21 to 31, which is going to transition us into God's calling of Abram out of the land of Ur, of the Chaldees, and God's selection of the nation of Israel as his choice people that he's going to put his love upon. And so we're getting into that concept of God's sovereignty in terms of election of his own people. And so this line of Shem is very important as the root of God's elect people. There's 26 nations that are listed here. So you can see by way of prominence, you know, there were only a few nations in the first line there. There were only, what did I say, 14 or so that were listed. What did I say? Yeah, 14 nations in the first line, 30 nations in the sons of Ham, and 26 nations here in the sons of Shem. So that's how they're broken down. But here you have the introduction to the sons of Shem. So he's the father of all the children of Eber. Shem's the older brother of Japheth. And then it talks about the ones that were born to Shem, Elam and Asher and Arpachshad and Lud and Aram, the Semitic peoples. And it goes on and gives more specifics about the sons of Aram and then the sons of Arpachshad and their territory. And it references Eber in verse 24. Of course, Eber, that's related to the word, and Eber, you can probably hear it in the pronunciation, related to Hebrew. So the Hebrews come from this word Eber. So he's understood to be the ancestor of the Hebrew people, again, coming from this line of Shem. Then you have the two sons of Eber. You have Peleg and Joktan that were born there. And this concept of Peleg being around in the days when the earth was divided, again, drawing our focus to the Tower of Babel incident. In fact, his name means division, is what the name Peleg means. But here you have the line of Shem through Peleg. You've got what's going to be the genealogy of the Messiah who is to come. And so the seed of the woman is prominent in this section here of the sons of Shem that's involved. But it goes on and it identifies more specifically the sons of Joktan and who they are. And then it talks about their territory and how it extended from Mesha as you go towards Sephar, the hill country of the east. And then it gives that summary statement in verse 31. These are the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, by their lands, according to their nations. And then it gives that epilogue statement. That's the bookend to verse 1. So I don't have a whole lot more to say by way of application, by way of observation, just how this chapter divides itself. And basically, this chapter is gearing us up for our study of the Tower of Babel incident, just trying to emphasize for us the importance of that in the whole history of mankind. Just like so much prominence was given to Noah's flood. I mean, that was a hugely important event. The Tower of Babel is this next great important event that we're going to study next week. But I wanted to close with Acts chapter 17. Just as you get to the gospel records, and as we talk about the having a heart of evangelism and a heart for the people of the world, we want to think of what God's heart is as the creator of all mankind. And Genesis 10 is really what is in the background of what Paul has to say as he addresses the philosophers at Athens in Acts chapter 17. If you look at verse 26, as he's talking to the men of Athens, he stood in the midst of the Areopagus. Now I was okay with the other names, the Areopagus. And he says, "Men of Athens," he says, "I observe you're very religious in all respects, for while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made by hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things." And then he repeats the language that we've become familiar with from Genesis 10. "And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his children." And he goes on there. So this is, another testimony to the sovereignty of God and his creation and giving life to all the peoples of the earth with the intention that they might recognize him and exalt him as God, acknowledge his sovereignty, and have a desire to serve him. And so this is the backdrop that we have from these three distinct lines of nations, that the God who chose Israel, he's the sovereign God over all the nations.